Well, thank you very much, Catherine, for your very generous introduction and also for the very important work that CEDA and you on its behalf does throughout Australia to stimulate an intellectual consideration of Australia's future and what's required to deliver the future we want rather than the one that we think that we're going to get. I'd also thank David for the work that he does here with CEDA in South Australia. The key sponsors, Finlayson's, of course, and Deloitte, all of you, senior serving and former serving military officers and representatives of industry, thank you very, very much for being here. And I also saw a former friend and sometimes sparring partner, Professor Denise Bradley from the University of South Australia. To all of you, thank you very much for being here. And I do apologise for having to change the timetable. I have to have a meeting with the Prime Minister this afternoon in Sydney, so I had to change my schedule a bit. At least you'll be able to enjoy your lunch, because I was scheduled to launch this over lunch. I recognise, of course, the Kaurna, Aboriginal people who were here before we non-Indigenous Australians. At least I also know now from the comments made about turning off phones and how it's done in the military and Major General Hurley's suggestion that they just simply be disposed of while we're having problems with the accounting for our assets. So I'm only joking, David. It's interesting that we currently have a $53 billion asset portfolio, and defence industry and defence industry capability and the business of defence and sustaining that capability is very much a part and parcel of Australia's strategic defence outlook. And I think that too often Australians generally, and I think those in the political environment, have, I think, falsely taken for granted the capability that industry provides to Australia's defence and its forward outlook. There have, over the last 36 years, been quite a few attempts to examine defence industry and what sort of framework might actually govern it. We've had major defence industry statements in 1986, 1992, 1994, and 2002 to 2004. We've had defence industry reviews in 1970, 1986, 1988, 1989, 1990, 1991, 1994, and 1997. We've also had attempts at defence industry policy in 1983, 1987, 1993, 1997, 1998, which in my opinion was probably the best, which was led by Bronwyn Bishop, and 2000. So this is an area where considerable attempt has been made over the years to give thought to defence industry policy and how it might be framed. It's necessarily complex and reflected by the number of inquiries, reviews, industry statements and so on, because of a number of things. That defence industry and defence policy in relation to it has a significant impact on Australia's security. It also involves vast sums of money. And as you're aware, the budget for the DMO last year was $7.3 billion. It'll go to $8.7 billion this year. In addition to that, the Chief Information Officer will have $400 million to invest beyond basic IT on behalf of Defence. The Defence Housing Authority will have $400 million to invest in Defence housing. And the Defence Support Group, $1.9 billion. So over the next year alone, Defence will invest about $11 billion in the Australian economy in one shape or another. It's also extremely important for those of us who are privileged to serve Australia in public life and indeed at a ministerial level to appreciate that in defence that the decisions we make have a significant impact not only on those who lead industry but those who are employed by it, and that the decisions that we make in major procurement have an impact on the economic and social welfare not only of companies but indeed entire regions of Australia. The other thing that's important, which I think again underlines the complexity of defence industry policy and why a debate is such as presented in the CEDA paper, is the increasing complexity of defence technology and the industry from which it comes. And one of the things in the 6 months that I've had the privilege to be the Defence Minister that I've learned is that I have people constantly saying, oh, Australia should have bought something off the shelf. We do have a number of legacy projects about which we are concerned, and as we go forward in the future, notwithstanding the extraordinarily positive impact of the Kinnaird reforms on scheduling and value for money, we cannot afford to, nor will we ever, be risk averse in acquiring defence capability. If Australians really want an off-the-shelf defence capability, we will expose ourselves considerably and rely, obviously, in differentiation entirely on size, leadership, training and the calibre of those men and women who serve in the ADF. We will always seek to have an edge, but to do so within a responsible business framework and make responsible decisions in acquiring what we do in terms of capability. The key questions that I have put to the review of defence industry policy, which is occurring at the moment, and I asked the Minister Assisting, Bruce Bilson, to conduct those fora across the country, is what is and what defines a strategic capability for Australia, and how do we define it? What constitutes an industrially strategic capability for our nation? To what extent can the market actually support that? How can defence evaluate the merits of domestic industrial participation in procurement and sustainment in the absence of a strategic reason for actually having domestic capability? What actually constitutes minimum viability for any element of defence industry in Australia? What's the role for exports in sustaining our capability in Australia? What actually is value for money? And what are the human and social indicators that might inform that, which is the opaque prism of the political decision-making process with which at the moment many of you have to deal? It wouldn't surprise you to know I was asked at a public forum only 2 days ago whether in making the decision about the build of the LHD amphibs, whether we would take into account the region of Australia where principal construction work might occur. We also are concerned, and I'm particularly concerned, to improve the relationship between industry and the Defence Materiel Organisation. This is not should not be seen as a criticism of anyone who served in Defence Materiel Organisation in the past, nor indeed currently. In fact, I consider Malcolm Kinnaird and Stephen Gumley, respectively, to be the most important appointments that have been made in this area over the last 4 years. But I think that we need to appreciate that we must actively involve Australian defence industry in planning our long-term outlook, that we can't simply, on behalf of Australian industry and Australians generally, whether it be the government or through us, the Defence Materiel Organisation, in isolation from key information and the views of industry, set long-term planning for our country. It is, in every sense of the word, a partnership. And it's funny how things happen to you in life, but late last night when I was sitting on a plane coming here from Sydney, I was sitting next to a young bloke and I noticed there seemed to be half a dozen of these young guys who were very sensible, well-behaved young Australians, and this young bloke said to me, he saw some notes I was making, he said, oh, you got something to do with ships, have you? And I said, well, sort of. And he said, nothing to do with those warships, are you, that they're going to build in Adelaide? And I said, well, yeah, sort of. I'm kind of involved in the decision-making around that. And he said, oh, really? And he said, I work for ASC. I said, oh, dear, the Australian Submarine Corporation. He said, yeah, yeah. He said, we've just been to Hawaii for RIMPAC. And so I said, oh, OK. And I said to him, what's it like working at ASC? He said, oh, mate, he said, the place is really pumping. And he said, it's a great place. He said, I've got the best job in the world. He said, I work on maintenance and support for submarines. And he said, we haven't even started big time yet on the air warfare destroyers. And then I explained to him what I actually do. But and then his next question was, of course, oh, which design we're going to have? I said, I'll tell you in about July next year. And but nonetheless, he then went on to explain to me how the decisions that the government had made had had a significant impact not only on his own life but that of his family and many of his mates and those whom he knows. So In that sense, in that context in particular, I particularly thank and congratulate CEDA for putting the papers together, and in particular for the contributors, who've many of whom I've come to know. The key themes in the papers are the tension, firstly, between Australia's needs for domestic capabilities and the benefits of buying from high-volume overseas sources, and the tension between market competition and the need to help suppliers survive in a single buyer environment, and the alignment of procurement and maintenance with national defence strategy. Again, the key themes, as I say, that we've put into the Defence Industry Policy Review. And in that sense, by the way, when the draft paper for defence industry has been developed and I have approved it, I intend to release it to industry for you to consider so that we can achieve as best we can a broad consensus before I take it forward to my Cabinet colleagues for hopefully their endorsement. Paul Dibb has argued in the papers for a closer alignment between defence strategy and defence industry, and I think Paul's instincts are right, especially insofar as industry can plan for what defence needs by way of equipment or maintenance support. But if we were to go down the road that is proposed by Paul, I think we would certainly invite criticism from industry that government advice is prejudiced by the big end of town. Certainly the SMEs in Australia think that that is already the case, and I think if we were to take Paul's advice and apply it as it is, as it's given to policy, we would be subject to even more of that criticism. We'd need the DMO with better market awareness, and I agree with that, and also broad industry participation, as I say, in long-term strategic policy. I think increasingly, and I know Lieutenant General Major Hurley and Steve Gumley and others in the DMO recognise that very much. And in that sense, by the way, I repeat what I've said publicly before, I don't actually see a problem with people going from industry to the DMO and the DMO from industry. In fact, I think it's a very, very important and positive thing so long as we've got the probity arrangements appropriately in place. Indigenous capability is important, but it's not important at any price. As a government, we are prepared to pay a premium for Indigenous build, but as you can imagine, not to the extent of being subject to extortion. My friend Admiral Chris Barry has again proposed a national service. I see him arrive a little late for the function. He's obviously been out getting fitted for a uniform again. Look, emotionally, I suspect there are very few of us in this room that would not be supportive of national service in one form or another. It's up there somewhere, jammed somewhere between capital punishment and euthanasia in terms of public support in Australia, neither of which I support, I hasten to add. In an emotional sense, I think there are many Australians who say, yeah, it'd be a great thing if we had national service. I've met a number of men who were conscripts and did national service in Australia in an earlier generation, and many of them say it was the best years of their lives, but there are others who were destroyed by it. We have significant challenges ahead, which Chris quite rightly has identified in recruitment, a very tight labour market, collapsing age dependency ratios. I think defence generally is not yet a 21st century employer, and there is a lot that we can do in terms of recruitment, which I'm about to take to my colleagues for consideration in terms of reform and changes to the way in which careers and other things are managed within the ADF. But also, it would be extremely divisive in Australian society to introduce national service, and I cannot imagine an Australian government giving serious consideration to it unless, of course, Australia was facing a direct military threat to its own security. It would also have an impact on the labour market if you took an 18-year-old cohort out of the labour market for perhaps a two-year period. And also, Chris's colleagues who are still in uniform tell me with some enthusiasm and stridency that they're not particularly enthusiastic about taking their military leadership to train people who don't actually want to be in the Australian Defence Force and who will be there for as short a time as a government might otherwise dictate. So for those and many other reasons, we are not about to embrace national service, but it is a debate that, that I think is very useful in the sense of prompting all of us to think about recruitment and retention. Richard Babbin-Smith examines four areas for Indigenous R&D, and he argues that Australia is unique, which it is, and its needs can't be met in a timely manner by foreign suppliers. But others argue that we can't afford tailor-made systems. I mean, if you look at our cooperation that I've announced, I think, last week with the US Navy for Air 7000, the multi-mission UAVs, that is a good illustration of us needing maritime surveillance capability with UAVs. But it's state-of-the-edge art technology. It's right on the edge. We must work with those, particularly the US Navy, which are developing it. Mark Thompson argues strategic thinking is a means for developing strategic industry, and he cites the air warfare destroyers as an exception, but says that sector plans have been. He says that generally we're not doing enough strategically as far as working with industry is concerned. I'd say the sector plans have been good guidance, and they've been part of continuously developing cycle. Once you wait till we get to September, and we've put a lot of work into defence industry policy, and I think I'd suggest to Mark, for whom I have a very high regard, that we just wait and see what we choose to do. Geoffrey Barker has argued in the papers that the strong alliance with the United States influences our equipment choice. Obviously, we take into account interoperability with our allies, whether it's New Zealand, the United Kingdom, the United States, or anybody else. But, we went to BAE for the Hawk lead-in fighter. We went to the Eurocopter armed reconnaissance helicopter. We recently announced MRH-90, and I can assure you that the Sikorsky people were disappointed with that decision. And the Huon-class mine hunters, of course, are a derivative of the Italian Gaeta class. So there are many illustrations of the Australian government making decisions to purchase key assets from other than our American allies. In concluding, the thrust of the publication, I suppose there are three things. The first is that the government's geostrategic determinations will prescribe likely scenarios around which general defence capability needs to develop. Secondly, these general capabilities will be the foundation for identification of specific strategic capabilities that need to be developed in local industry and to ensure through-life support. And thirdly, the capacity of local suppliers to enter global supply chains of global primes will be an important factor in determining local levels of activity. And, of course, the Joint Strike Fighter is just but one illustration of that. So to you, Catherine, and your colleagues, thank you and congratulations. And it's my privilege to be able to officially launch the CEDA publication, The Business of Defence Sustaining Capability. Thank you very much.